Wendy Harmer, welcome, and we're honoured to have you. Welcome to the Last Post podcast series. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Nice to be with you.
Thank you, Wendy. We're here to talk about your latest book, The Amazing Lies My Mirror Told Me, out through Allen and Unwin. You've been a journalist, still a journalist, a playwright, comedian. You've been on radio and TV. The last I remember of you, Wendy, was during my five-year period living in New South Wales, when I was lucky enough to be able to tune in to hear you and Robbie introduce us to each day. That was a fantastic part of radio history. Did you enjoy that, and what are your memories of that?
Oh, well, that was great fun. I mean, I started out on mornings on ABC Sydney. I did that for a couple of years. And then the powers that be decided that perhaps Robbie and I should do the breakfast show together. And I guess we were both pretty wary of it at the start, and how we were going to make it work, because we'd never worked together before. And the listeners were underwhelmed and saying, why do we need two presenters? Blah, blah, blah. But anyway, very shortly, we found that we really did have a great chemistry, and the audience warmed to it. And when we left the program, we were on 15.9, which was the highest rating that the breakfast show had garnered since ratings were kept. So that was pretty good going.
Yeah. No, it was fantastic stuff, and a really good piece of radio history. Now, Wendy, I guess the prologue to your book, Lies My Mirror Told Me, explains the reasons behind the title of this release. Can you explain to readers and listeners the story behind your relationship with the mirror from an early age?
Yes, well, I was born with a bilateral cleft palate and cleft lip rather than palate. And so most these days, about 1 in 800 babies are born with clefts. And these days, at about 6 months, or 3 to 6 months, babies have their first, you know, operations with the microsurgery and so on. And that's pretty much the last operation that they'll ever need. But when I was born in 1955, well, plastic surgery was a pretty, well, it was much a really evolving area of surgery. Mm. And so what happened with me, I just had my, you know, my face sort of patched up in a fairly rudimentary fashion. And so I was to wait for my final surgery till I was 14 years old. So the title comes from one day I came home from school and the boys had been picking on me, calling me eagle beak and flat face and pancake head and Wendy the witch. And I said to my mother, I said, you know, and I told my mother, and she said, well, I want you to go and look in the mirror, and when you can find something to complain about, you come out and tell me.
Right.
Well, you know, Greg, there was a fair bit to complain about. You know, my face was a lot more, you know, flat than it is now. My nose was broader. And I just had this sort of top lip that was very wonky, just sort of stitched up. And I had like no, just little stumps of upper teeth going sideways. So, you know, I could see there was a lot to complain about. Mm. But I decided to come out and say to my mother, I've got nothing to be sorry for. And so, I don't know, that's where the idea came from. And what I have I've done in the book is that every chapter starts with me looking into a mirror.
That's right.
And that's,
yeah,
you know, from when I was little, when I had my operation, then when I went into stand-up comedy and, you know, backstage at the Logies, getting ready to go to the Oscars, doing stand-up comedy, you know, the lot. So that's the setup.
Yeah, it's a brilliant way to do a book, and I noticed that while I was reading it. It was brilliant. Your parents, I mean, this is a part of the book I found extremely interesting was your childhood, because, of course, a lot of people in Australia followed you and know your career to a certain degree, but didn't know this about you. So they were seen, I guess, as you put it in the book, Wendy, as Woodend's dream couple. Your father, Graham, with his aerial twin motorbike and his Oldsmobile Tourer, and he was movie star handsome, and your mother, years younger but with a striking independence and the two of them got together through all the trials and tribulations of the time, and you explain that well in the book. So that's an incredible thing, I guess. They were married in 1955, but after the wedding, Margaret was asked if they were going to start a family, and she replied, "No, we're going to breed whippets." So that was
Yeah, well, that's right. My mother was born in Tassie, and she had been brought up by her grandmother because her parents had separated. And so her grandmother didn't tell her anything about birth control. So my mother actually believed the old wives' tale that if she just grew parsley, she wouldn't become pregnant. But she started going out with my father when she was just 14 years old and he was 20.
That's right.
And then she was married at 16 and had me, almost to the day after their wedding night. And, yeah, so she was very young. And by the time she was 22, she'd had four children, a miscarriage and an ectopic pregnancy. And after that ectopic pregnancy, she woke up to the doctor saying, "We think that you've been through enough, so we've given you a tubal ligation. We've tied your tubes." And they hadn't asked her about this.
I read that, yeah.
And so, I guess that's really sort of where she marks her mental decline, you know, her postnatal depression, all that, which led to her attempted suicide when I was 10 through taking an overdose.
Yes, that's right. I read about that in the book, and I'll get to that in just a moment, if you don't mind, Wendy. But I think when your mother was younger, do you think when she was taken by your father, Graham, in the motorbike, do you think, and she approached Graham, of course, or at least they got together serendipitously initially, do you think that she followed him because she was looking for a way out?
Oh, yes, I very much think so. Yeah, she was living with her mother by then, and her mother had on the mainland in Wood End, and her mother had taken her out of high school and sent her to work in the local factory sewing underwear. So, yeah, I very much think that she thought that, you know, she and Dad would find a way out of it together. And they were really, you know, they were well suited to each other. They both liked lagoons, you know, and they both were very voracious readers, Dad being a school teacher.
Yeah.
And, I think that's what she thought would happen.
Yeah. It was incredible. And you'd go into detail so well. I think Tarraville, and then is it Warncourt? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, Warncourt.
Yeah.
Yes, Dad taught it, a whole lot of, through his career, a little one and two teacher country schools. Mm. There was a while there where we lived in Bendigo in California Gully, and he taught at Camp Hill, which is a huge school in the middle of Bendigo.
That's right.
But apart from that, we lived in these little tiny schools in the school residence.
Yeah, it's incredible. I went to a similar school in Coolum, and where all the students were in one room, so you'd know about that.
Yes, same.
Incredible. You, with your brothers and sister Helen, and you describe a yearning as a child for the 180 degree skies of that part of your childhood in the country. It sounds beautiful. What are your memories of that time when you would go out with your brothers and sister there, and you love the flatlands, you said, and all that sort of stuff? That must have been quite beautiful.
Well, this was in when we were at Warncourt, which is a beautiful, the Aboriginal name for it, it means up and down like a bandicoot running. Isn't that a fantastic, you know, description? And that's of the flat plains in the Western District with these stony rises, up and down like a bandicoot running. And, of course, we had a whale of a time, really, because not only were there paddocks as far as you can see, and, you know, the cypress windbreak, you know, the very, very typical landscape of that time. But also, when all the other kids went home, we had the schoolroom all to ourselves, and we had the monkey bars and the slides and the bats and the balls and the books and the lot. So there was, even though my childhood, it has a had a lot of travails, there was that growing up in the country was a wonderful thing, and we were very close, the four of us.
Yes, I think it comes across in the book. And something, Wendy, too, I think that serves as a credit in the positive side of life to go through that. I know that we had relatives up in Queensland and we would visit them occasionally and always look forward to that because it was the milking of the cows, the running through the hills, and even, yeah, just amazing things. So I identified with that and read that very thoroughly. So it was lovely. You detailed before about the first 14 years of your life being endless trips to specialists and operations and adjustments, etc. And of course, your mother, you also talk about guilt and shame, the revving two engines of your mother's life. Is this in relation, do you think, to she felt trapped, or what were the reasons behind that, do you think?
Well, I mean, she had these four kids, and Dad was off playing footy a lot of the time and wouldn't come home, or he'd be in the pub with his mates. And she really missed Tasmania. When she tried to take her life, we were living in Bendigo, which she thought was horribly flat and dry, as she says in the book, she just come to the end of the line and she wanted it over and done with. And she had been taking Seconal, the doctor had prescribed them, and that's what she tried to overdose on. She wasn't successful, but what happened then was she went back to live in Tasmania on a permanent basis. And so by about the age of 10, 11, she came home a couple of times, or came home once at least, and then she left again. So from the age of 11, there was like Dad and the four kids, and we all sort of muddled along, tried to make the best of it, with me being surrogate mum in many ways at a very early age.
Yeah, that's right. You described that well. And your father's love of poetry, and his ability to speak, I see that in you. Do,
Oh,
what do you, what do you
yes.
think, what do you think of that? Is that obviously parts that you got from your father?
Well, my father was very determined that I would have no impediment to my speech from my, cleft palate and everything. So from a very early age, he would have me sit at the kitchen table and read aloud from the newspaper.
How beautiful.
And he'd also have me sing for visitors, but I would only do it if I could stand behind a door. So I was Dad's special project, and yes, he was a beautiful speaker. He could give the most magnificent speeches, wonderfully well spoken. So yes, he prized that very highly, and I guess I get that from him. A funny thing. On the night, first night I hosted a big gig on TV, I rang my dad and he said, "I thought your diction was quite good," he said.
Oh, how brilliant. And you were quite in your element because you had the sun in the morning and the herald at
Yeah, there you go. Yeah,
night.
I started working at the Geelong Advertiser. I started as a copy girl there, the
That's right, yeah.
first female on the editorial floor in 130 something years.
God
And
damn.
then from there I went to the mighty Sun News pictorial newspaper in Melbourne.
That's the right, the building in Flinders Street. And I was a copy boy for the Sydney Morning Herald, so I identified with that too. And yeah, old days. And I was blessed once to be asked into an editor's or a sub-editor's meeting or something. And just to watch them all in action. Wendy, you must have got the same buzz.
Well, I was on the sub-editor's desk for a while. Most people at the Sun at that time had a go on the subs desk. And just watching that newspaper being put to bed every night, and then there were four editions, and the
That's
final
right.
one wouldn't go out till about 3 o'clock in the morning or
That's
whatever.
right.
So yeah, it was and with the Herald and the Sun being in the same building there in Melbourne, and the printing press underneath on site, and the whole building would thrum and vibrate. Very exciting times, and sometimes I'd have to go up to the stone to because it was hot metal type in those days,
Yeah.
and deal with the blokes, who are in overalls, and was boiling hot, no one can hear anything, and Jeez. And that is obviously, a time that is long gone. So I really enjoyed, and I consulted a lot of my Juno mates about those times, but I really enjoyed putting that time down too as a memory of a, production that's long gone, of course.
And there was a pub nearby too. That's
Oh, well, isn't there always a pub
then,
nearby?
that's
And
right.
for the, yeah.
That's right. There
What
used to
was
be,
it for the Sydney Morning Herald?
yeah, that's right, Wendy. There was a pub on Broadway, and when you had to go to get some news to the sub editors or whatever, you'd find them in the front bar, normally with my father.
Oh, how about that? Well, for us, it was the Phoenix just across the road. And that where you go up this flight of stairs, which I saw a lot of journos fall down, I must admit. You go up to that the top bar there where all the blokes were. And I tried to keep myself nice for a long time. But I remember once I went across the road to the pub and I would look, I rang back to the chief of staff and I said, I'm too drunk to come back and finish my story. And he said, "Hooray, you're one of us. We wondered when that had happened." Oh, so they were hard drinking times, of course.
Yeah, that's right. How funny, Wendy. How funny. That's right. Indeed. A lot of the stories were procured from the front bars of various pubs around the country. And what was it like to work with Paulie Stewart and Mark Trevorrow, of course?
Oh, well, there we were, the three of us banging away on the old Remington typewriter and tearing, bit sheets of copy paper. We were all sitting at we sat at adjoining desks, and we just laugh ourselves silly. I mean, we had absolutely no idea we'd all end up in showbiz, but that's how it worked out. And they're both great friends of mine to this day.
Oh, excellent. Well, that's and that's right. Yes, no, they're very true too. Good. You use the word resilient in the book, and you talk about whether or not you're born with resilience, but is it something you found along the way, resilience?
Well, babies are not born with resilience. I mean, it's not a genetic trait. And some kids, I guess, in adverse circumstances, never really develop those attachments. They're just born with that, like that. But for me, what we now know about resilience is that it's built up over time and really requires, a constant attachment from one adult, really. That's what you need. And I guess it's because there was a comment on social media which I thought was amazing. Said, "Oh, lucky you, Wendy. You've got resilience." I'm thinking, luck? Luck's got nothing to do with it,
How insulting. How insulting. I know that I can understand that. And when people don't understand the stories behind, I actually got an abusive email for the first time about 3 weeks ago because I wasn't able to fit any editorial story from this chap into the edition. But I had to explain to all about actually what goes on in a publisher's life just to educate them. And of course, when someone says that to you about lucky you, then that's probably says more about the person saying it, because if you believe resilience is luck, then I don't know where that comes from, actually.
Yeah, I know. It was an odd statement to make. I mean, I was really lucky, even though that, we moved around a lot and I was often the funny looking kid in the wrong colour school uniform at the schools that I went to. But the thing that I did have was my father, and those schoolrooms for me, they really provided a safe haven and rules and order. You knew the bell was going to go at 3, 9, and you'd finish at 3. So I think that gave me a lot of stability. And I almost sort of substituted a schoolroom for a family life in some ways.
Yes. Well said. Well said. And I think we'd gone to a lot of schools during our life because of dad's you speak of post-traumatic stress, and of course, with your relatives in war, Dad obviously experienced that, but it was undiagnosed at the time. We travelled around a lot, and we did go to a lot of schools. And I think if we stayed at one place for 3 years, that was like a lifetime for us. So I can understand that very much. Just on to comedy, Les Jokes. Now, what you first appeared there? Tell us a bit about that. It's a magnificent venue, or it was. I haven't been there for years.
Well, I don't think it's a venue anymore. I mean, but yeah, well, how I got into comedy is a weird story because I was at the Sun News by this time, and I was I'd done the industrial round, I'd done transport, I'd done general, I'd done the courts, a brief stint at police rounds, then I'd done town hall round. And by this time, I was having a dabbling at state rounds. And I thought, oh, well, if I stay here and then I'll go on to the Canberra Press Gallery and then maybe I'll be, foreign correspondent or something. And this particular day, one of the features editor, she said, can you go out and do a story about this new wave of comedy, this so-called,
That's right.
alternative comedy cabaret? And I went along to report on it, and there I went, and I ran away and joined the circus. That's pretty much all you got to know.
Led you on to some great successes, and what a great venue that was too. And we're so glad that you joined the it was a new wave actually in the 80s. A lot of people hadn't seen that
It
type of
was,
comedy,
it was.
and a lot of
Yeah,
talented
because we'd
people.
had, we, yeah, we had, you remember in, Britain, there was not the 9 o'clock news, and then we had the people out of good, what were they
The
called?
young ones, and then
Yeah, your young ones. We had French and Saunders and all that. And over in America, there was Whoopi Goldberg and so forth. And so here in Australia, there was a huge blossoming of that kind of, brand new kind of comedy. And with a really different, I think, sensibility than there had been. It was sort of half punk and,
I agree.
anarchic.
Yes,
Yeah. And
yes.
so there I was right in the middle of that. And so that was really
Was
fantastic
Trios
fun.
Ring Barkers?
Well, exactly. I saw them on the night that I went out to report on this new wave of comedy. They were performing that night. I mean, they just blew me away. Richard Stubbs was performing. Gina Riley was in a girls group, and Steve
Jeez.
Vizard was doing a character called Buddy Chuck with Paul Grabowski playing the piano. I mean, what wasn't to love? It was just so I couldn't wait to join. And the funny thing about it is, I went back to the office and I wrote the story and I started going to comedy clubs. And then I walked in one day and said, "Well, I'm leaving," and I went to join a community, a free newspaper. And because I wanted a couple of days off to be able to work on my comedy, and so I said, "I'm leaving," and they said, "What? What do you mean you're leaving?" And so I found out later that all my colleagues at the Sun were thinking about having an intervention. And even when I was hosting the big gig, and I remember going back and visiting my colleagues, oh, they said, "Oh, I've come for your old job back, have you?" I went, "No."
Ye of little faith, Wendy. Ye of little faith. Well, we thank you so much, Wendy. There's so much to cover in this book, Lies My Mirror Told Me, out through Allen and Unwin, and it's such a readable book. There's so much in there, but as I said before, detailing a lot of your life that a lot of people may not have known, and also the fact that Henry Bowlby may still owe some money to you. Jeez,
To the Skipton Football Club.
God damn it!
Well, that's what my grandfather used to say. Every time he saw Henry Bolte on TV, he would say, "That bastard still owes me £7, 10 shillings, and 6 pence." So I don't know whether that's still owed by the Bolte family, but maybe they'll be in touch.
Well, he's hoping, Wendy. He's hoping if we achieve nothing else, may it be that.
All
So
right.
it's been a pleasure, Wendy. Thank you so much for joining us.